I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Well, maybe not a lot of people see Julian Assange as dignified particularly, but luckily the founders protected freedom of the press. Julian Assange has been called a vile creature. What better place to kick off a new undermining of America's long-treasured, constitutionally protected freedom of the press than on someone who a lot of people really don't like? How outside the traditional bounds of publishing and journalism is this generally reviled founder of WikiLeaks? What is the truth of the grounds for his forced removal from his 7 years sanctuary in the London Ecuadorian embassy and arrest? What lies ahead in terms of prosecution for this controversial figure and for the possibility of undermining our long-held press freedom under the Trump Justice Department? Our comparisons with Daniel Ellsberg, leaker of the Pentagon Papers, warranted or off track? Well, our guest today, Sandra Davidson, wrote an article back in 2011, right after the big data transfer by Chelsea Manning to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. The title of her article in 2011 was Leaks, Leakers, and Journalists, Adding Historical Context to the Age of WikiLeaks. She is not exactly a newcomer to this issue. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, with the recent apprehension of Assange and the myriad controversies surrounding it, now is an ideal time to look into what is real and what is perhaps dangerous hyperbole. Sandra Davidson, PhD, JD, teaches media law at the University of Missouri School of Journalism and School of Law. She's also the attorney for the Columbia Missourian, the newspaper published by the School of Journalism. She's been teaching media law there since 1989. She's also taught media law at the University of Missouri School of Law. She also teaches law and the justice system at the School of Journalism. Now, media law, we don't often think about it, but with this new development, those genuine constitutional conservatives among us, and I consider myself one of them, who truly treasure a free press and our freedoms as Americans, might want to be paying attention to this story. Might the freedoms we take for granted be under a new and serious threat? Or is what Assange did truly outside the bounds of acceptable journalism? So much to figure out. Well, first off, Professor Davidson, Sandy, what was the legal basis for his arrest in London? What is Assange charged with by the United Kingdom? And does the UK have to comply with a request for extradition? And what would the
I think it's kind of interesting that the Metropolitan Police Service had said originally that Assange was arrested on a warrant issued by the Westminster Magistrates Court for failing to surrender to the court. That was a June 29, 2012 warrant. And also the police service said it had a duty to execute the warrant. But the most recent spin on this is a confirmation that Assange was, quote, arrested on behalf of the United States authorities. And this is coming from the Washington Post. So the United States has wanted to get its hooks into Assange. And, of course, he's spent the last 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy. Also, he's had problems with Sweden, where he has been accused of sexual assault, rape, but at one point in time, the Swedish authorities appeared to have dropped that charge, but now it seems that that's an issue again. So the question, will Assange end up in the United States?
Right.
Well, I think it's possible that first he'll have a detour to Sweden.
Ah, but if there is, as I expect, a request for extradition, does the United Kingdom have to comply? And what do you think the United States would charge him with?
Well, the UK, of course, is one of our allies. So, you know, this is wrapped up in the political and the legal machinery. Sometimes countries won't extradite. For instance, France would not extradite Roman Polanski when he was charged with the rape, and he pleaded guilty of a 13-year-old girl, a statutory rape. So if what is going on in one country is just beyond the pale for the country that is holding the person, you know, it's not illegal under that country's laws, then the country that already has the person won't release the person to the country wanting him. But I don't think we have that kind of situation here. Let's say that the extradition happens. Then the question is, what kind of law will be used to prosecute Assange? And this is where I start in getting quite worried. My understanding is that Assange is being charged with conspiracy under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Basically, he conspired to illegally invade material on a computer. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about conspiring with Chelsea Manning.
Mm-hmm. And conspiring, I'm reminded of the 1969 case of the Chicago 8 when they were charged with conspiring. You don't actually have to do it just to conspire. It's a little bit fuzzy. And of course, they were found eventually not guilty. But did he, I wonder if the charges that he encouraged Chelsea Manning to hack the Pentagon computers, did he participate in that? Did he try to get her the code? And is that within the bounds of freedom of the press and journalism? I mean, journalists don't expect stories to land in their lap. They got to do some digging. They got to do some ferreting out.
Well, but sometimes stories do land in their lap.
Sometimes,
so now we've got a factual matter. Did Assange indeed conspire with Bradley Manning at the time, now Chelsea Manning, or was this a situation where Manning instead decided to get this information to Assange, and Assange had what we would call clean hands? It makes a great deal of difference in the law. If a reporter has clean hands, has not done anything to try to get information, then the courts say that the reporter has one job, and that's to determine if the information is of legitimate public concern. Namely, is the information newsworthy? And there have been a couple of situations where, indeed, reporters have gotten information. There was a case involving Senator Dodd and columnist Anderson. And what we had was some of Dodd's aides had copied some of the files of the senator and just given the files to a couple of reporters who then did their reporting. And the Supreme Court let stand the opinion that so long as they had clean hands, they were free to use it. And the Supreme Court did accept a case concerning this situation. Congress had, as part of our illegal wiretapping law, that if you disseminated information that you either knew or had reason to believe was illegally intercepted, then you had violated the interception law. And the U.S. Supreme Court struck that law down.
Interesting.
What we had had was a situation with a big union blow up, and a tape had been made of one of the union representatives, and talking about blowing up porches. It was an incendiary tape, and it was highly newsworthy. And the Supreme Court was just reiterating what has been the law. Again, if you did not have your sticky fingers in it, if you had clean hands and you received the information, the courts aren't going to make you play 20 questions to try to figure out if there was any sort of illegal interception. Think how that would slow down the news process. No, one job. Is this of legitimate public concern?
Interesting. Well, I don't know a lot about the data that was leaked and published, and I think that's a key word, published in WikiLeaks, but I do know about the collateral murder video that Bradley Manning at the time then leaked to WikiLeaks. And I would say that was unquestionably newsworthy information. So I wonder about, you know, does that situation, which was, I mean, it showed a video of an American helicopter murdering people on the ground.
Yes.
Does that situation leave Julian Assange with, as you say, clean hands?
Well, what it leaves him with is something that is highly newsworthy.
Yes.
If he had clean hands, and the question was, is this of legitimate public concern? Oh, my goodness, of course it is.
Absolutely.
Now, that does not answer the question, though, of whether he, in fact, was aiding, abetting, conspiring with Manning to get that material. And again, that is something that at this point in time, we're just not sure about. There's that allegation, and part of the trouble here is how much do you trust our government on what it's alleging? It has to prove it in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. Hmm. I think that one of the comments that Daniel Ellsberg made, you know, right after Manning was arrested and all, and Ellsberg very much has come to the aid of Manning and of Snowden. But the remark by Ellsberg, secrecy is essential to empire. This fear of secrecy, that is something that I share with Ellsberg, and I share with Louis Brandeis, who 3 years before he became a Supreme Court justice, was writing about sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Yes.
So what I do want to see is transparency. I think transparency is critical if we're going to have a functioning democratic government.
Boy, I'd say so. And I wish I had, there was a quote from JFK, who was no, you know, flaming liberal. He was very much concerned about secrecy and the cult of secrecy. And that does seem to be the case now. And we've come so far, and, you know, revealing secrets. When Ellsberg did his thing with the Pentagon Papers, he got some information surreptitiously. I don't think it was on a computer, but the Pentagon Papers was a secret document, and he did leak that. And of course, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe all published that. Do you think comparisons between Danny Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers situation are appropriate? Is it an appropriate comparison now? And in what ways?
I surely do think it is. You know, volumes and volumes. Daniel Ellsberg, who was working on the Pentagon Papers, leaked to a New York Times reporter. And when you get over 40 volumes of leaked information, of course, then you have to have a whole herd of reporters who work on this. And I think it's remarkable that within 13 days of the first publication, you have the U.S. Supreme Court hearing the Pentagon Papers case. What we are talking about is prior restraint. So, 2 days after the Pentagon Papers story broke, and it broke on the front page of the New York Times, and on one side of the page, you had Nixon escorting his daughter, Tricia. She was getting married, so you had the marriage story, and then you had the big Pentagon Papers story. It indeed had a lot of information that the government did not want the public to see. But right. This was prior to the internet. Instead of having a big download, the New York Times was giving this information out through its wire service to other newspapers. So trying to just shut down the New York Times, we had a kind of a whack-a-mole situation. You know, then other newspapers would pick it up.
Right.
But within 48 hours, there was the Justice Department taking the New York Times into federal court. And if this would have been a novel, people would have said it's absolutely too hokey.
Yes.
It was Judge Murray Gerfein's first day on the bench as a federal trial judge. So, you know, what can happen the first day? You're finding out where the coffee pot is, that kind of thing. In comes the Justice Department saying that the New York Times has to be shut down, the biggest newspaper in the country, of course. And if that shutdown doesn't occur, then we are going to have irreparable damage to the defense interest of the United States. So can you imagine that poor judge having to decide that? So
it does sound similar.
What he said, his first decision, all right, we will shut down the New York Times. But 2 days later, when the government came back, it wanted to go from a temporary restraining order to a preliminary injunction. Judge Gerfein had had time to think about it. And he talked about how important a safety valve we had in our democratic system, you know, with the news. And he said, no, we will not have a preliminary injunction.
Right.
But he was overruled by the Second Circuit. So we got the New York Times shut down. In the meantime, the Washington Post is picking up this same situation. And it was Judge Gerhard Gesell who first said, all right, I'll give the government its temporary restraining order. And then he said no to a preliminary injunction. And now it went to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And we had another hero. His name was George Wilson. He was a reporter for the Washington Post. And he maybe he wasn't too fashionable. He carried around this kind of green plastic knapsack, but he carried a lot of interesting information in it. So, okay, we're in front of the Court of Appeals. It's Judge David Bazelon, and he hears from the Justice Department that any more publication of the Pentagon Papers is going to leak important information and will be irreparably harming this country. So the judge says, come into my chambers. And in comes the government, in comes the attorneys for the Washington Post, and George Wilson, the reporter. So behind closed doors, the government attorney reveals that the Pentagon Papers will expose that we had broken the code of the North Vietnamese Navy. And when those words came out of the attorney's mouth, it triggered something in George Wilson. He had heard that before. So he started digging around in his little green knapsack, and up he came with a congressional report that had already told the nation if anybody wanted to read the report, that we had broken that code. Mm. So the judge said, no, we're not going to enjoin the Washington Post. And in the wake of this, we have the New York Times shut down, the Washington Post getting the green light, the mm-hmm. Supreme Court takes the case. So 13 days after the first publication, we have arguments in front of the Supreme Court. 4 days later, we have the decision in the Pentagon Papers case. And the court is emphasizing that the most important part of the First Amendment is the guarantee against government censorship.
Yes.
And that's what we had going on here. If you want to shut anybody down, then you have the burden of proof. And the government simply did not meet its high burden of proof. So, the Pentagon Papers case, really a wonderful case.
Yes.
If what you're interested in is transparency.
Well, for those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. And we're speaking with Sandy Davidson, who back in 2011, she's a professor, teaches media law. She wrote Leaks, Leakers, and Journalists, Adding Historical Context to the Age of WikiLeaks, which brings up the question a lot of people are saying, but the New York Times, the Washington Post, they're legitimate publications. Now, is WikiLeaks, in legal terms, a publication? And are they therefore entitled to the same protections as a more traditional publication? I mean, people were saying today, oh, it's just trash, you know, it's garbage. Well, so bloody what? Excuse me. You know, the National Enquirer is trash too, but they're a public. And who the heck are we to say? I mean, my sense is that the freedom of the press is there to specifically protect offensive reports and things, you know, and offensive stories that we may not like. You know, it's there to protect freedom of the press. I get off a little bit there, but is WikiLeaks a publication, and is it therefore entitled to the same protection as a more traditional publication? What do you think?
And that is such an interesting question. Let's talk about what happened when WikiLeaks did get this information from Manning. Now, WikiLeaks was maintaining at the time that the way its equipment was set up, that it could not trace the source of information.
Ah.
So, anyway, we have this huge download of data. We have the collateral murder tape that you talked about. We
right.
had the Iraqi war logs, the Afghanistan war logs. Later on, we got diplomatic cables. But before Assange published anything on WikiLeaks, he gave this information to the New York Times, to Der Spiegel, which is the leading German newspaper,
right.
and The Guardian in England. And I think part of the rationale was he was hoping to get protection under the First Amendment with the New York Times being the first to publish this. But now, as to the question of whether WikiLeaks is a publication, we have an interesting First Amendment, freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
Amen.
At the time it was written, we had no broadcasters,
no.
but freedom of speech and of the press is broad enough to cover that new technology of broadcast. Clearly, it is also broad enough to cover the new technology of the internet. And we have a lot of major news sources, of course, that have their own internet sites. And then we've had some tweaking of law concerning when you're going to be liable for third-party postings and all of that. But for what anybody is publishing himself or herself, in effect, you have become a publisher
yes.
of that information. Please remember, we do not have any definition of who is a journalist in our Constitution. And back in 1972, the Supreme Court was having to try to figure out if the First Amendment gave protection to journalists if they wanted to protect their sources.
Right.
So could a journalist who got a subpoena to come and appear in front of a grand jury, and the grand jury order is reveal your source, could the journalist say, no, I have First Amendment protection not to do so? Well, the Supreme Court decided 5-4 that journalists did not have protection from revealing their sources. And I think one of the primary reasons, or at least a reason for that decision, if you say that journalists have a special protection, the next thing you have to do is define who is a journalist. We don't license journalists. The court in 72 did not want to have to answer that question. And it's become even more complicated today. And if you start in looking at laws trying to protect journalists who are trying to protect their sources, we have no federal protection, but 40 states do give shield law protection to journalists. And if you start in reading the definition of who is a journalist, it is all over the map. At one extreme, anyone who is publishing information to the public is a journalist and given shield law protection. At the other extreme, only persons who are receiving the majority of their income from a media corporation can qualify. So this is a big debate. I tend to think that anybody who wants to disseminate information to the public is operating under the umbrella of the First Amendment, freedom of speech and of the press. No definition, and I think wisely not.
Yes.
And we have, of course, Twitter. I mean, the technology will continue to develop. But I think it's the intent behind disseminating information that makes you a journalist.
Interesting. Yes, I think you've hit on some very good points there. And, you know, we like to talk about settled law. It doesn't seem to be settled law. As you say, it's all over the map, and 40 states have different definitions. I wonder about what process. I mean, there's no, as you say, legal constitutional definition of a journalist. What is the process for the government deciding which facts must remain secret and or classified? Is it up to the individual judgment of intelligence agents who are working on a particular sensitive issue? What is classified information that is appropriately classified as such, and what might be arbitrary classification or even classification for the purpose of a cover-up? That doesn't seem to be very clear either.
Right, and I think that is a very good point. We have a very complicated classification system, and sometimes what is classified clearly should not be. We had a situation where journalists were trying to publish information that they had, well, they were acting now as journalists, they had been in the CIA, and they wanted to talk about the cult of intelligence, and this went up to the Fourth Circuit, and here is what was kind of interesting. You had the CIA, of course, demanding and having the right to demand before anybody worked for the CIA that they agreed as a lifetime agreement that they would turn this information over to the CIA for prior clearance.
Right.
You might call that censorship.
Yeah.
In this situation with the CIA and the cult of intelligence, it's the Marchetti case is the name of it, you have something like 337 different places in this manuscript that the CIA says, you know, we want to strip that out, you know, way over 330, maybe 339. And the government ends up in this situation. 27 or so portions, the court said, indeed did need to come out. So, you know, you can have situations where over 10 times the amount of information that a court thinks should be stripped out, you know, the CIA thought should be stripped out. Sometimes you can get in-camera review where if you think that an agency has just gone beyond the pale by wanting to strip out so much information, then you can have court review to see, yes, is this needing to go? But there was also another case, United States Supreme Court decided this was the SNEP case, and you had a guy, again, working for the CIA, and he decided that it had been a decent interval of time since he had been working for the CIA in Vietnam. So he wrote the book Decent Interval.
Yes, Frank Snow.
Well, the Supreme Court of the United States said, we're not going to decide this based on the fact that he broke his agreement. Here's the deal. We have two very important interests. One is secrecy of information, and yes, the United States government has a right to have some information secret. And second, appearance of confidentiality. But Decent Interval had no secret information in it, no classified information. And the Supreme Court, you know, that was, I think that was fairly clear cut. But this notion of the appearance of confidentiality, the CIA head had said, when you have people like Snap who are going off writing these books, you know, revealing information, we have intelligence sources that are drying up. And the United States Supreme Court said, yes, protecting confidentiality of sources is very important. So the Supreme Court wanted an injunction against Snap so he would have to push any further manuscripts in front of the CIA, and the CIA wanted all of the profits from Snep's book. The CIA got both.
Really? Wow, interesting. Well, I guess that's where the data came from. And, you know, in terms of legitimate secrecy, the CIA, as we were talking about, often relies on friendly nations providing information to the CIA with the security of knowing that the sources will not be identified. What Assange and Manning revealed, is there not a potential danger to the personal safety of foreign agents? People are concerned about that. Did Manning and Assange put CIA agents personally at risk? And if so...
Yes, I think that is a very important point, because there are allegations that indeed there was not enough of a combing of this information before this massive amount of information was put out, and indeed it did put some people at risk. And there's another quote that I really like, and this is from Justice Robert Jackson. He said, "The Constitution is not a suicide pact." You know, and I think that's important to remember. The government does sometimes have legitimate reasons to shut down information. And of course, if you look at the Freedom of Information Act, you have a lot of important exemptions, such as for national security. Mm-hmm. But, and here's my problem, you can have agencies that do just simply go too far. And then you have the Supreme Court that sometimes upholds it. I think for anybody who thinks we have real freedom of information in this country, you know, I would ask them to read CIA versus SIMS, spelled just S-I-M-S. This is a case, 1985, U.S. Supreme Court, and it involves the CIA's program called MK-Ultra. Now, what was going on? It's kind of like the Manchurian Candidate, yeah, if you want, where you know you can get people who can be triggered by something they're on, some sort of psychedelics or some sort, under the influence of some sort of drugs, and they become just kind of like automatons if they get this triggering mechanism. Well, that's kind of the background thought. So the CIA has this program, and it does get a lot of researchers involved in it. The CIA is using human beings as guinea pigs, giving them drugs, LSD, for one, not telling them that they are on the drugs, trying to see basically what you can do in terms of controlling people and all if you do give them some of these drugs. And the Supreme Court said that, you know, there had been, you know, a couple of deaths because of this program. A scientist had had a bad trip on LSD and crashed through a window and died. But the Supreme Court did let national security prevail over request trying to get this information about MK Ultra. And again, the concern that you would end up identifying people and all this. In 2015, we finally had a win, though, upheld by the Ninth Circuit, when you had some of the guinea pigs, if I may use that phrase, some of the people who were in the military and who were given drugs, not knowing, not consenting to what was happening to them, they did get to find out their personal medical information.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive. Our guest today is Professor Sandra Davidson, who is she teaches media law at the University of Missouri School of Journalism and School of Law. We're talking about the legal context, the precedents regarding the Julian Assange case. And as we all know, I mean, Trump hates the media. We thought Nixon hated the media. He's called them the enemy of the people. And, you know, it does concern me. And, you know, journalists, a lot of them are kind of, you know, throwing Assange under the bus. But Trevor Timm, executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, is addressing journalists with this concern. He says, please do not fall for this trap. It is exactly what the Trump administration is hoping for as the Department of Justice moves forward with its next dangerous step in its war on journalism and press freedom. How much of a, I mean, is this distinct and separate, this Assange case, or can it be the first, you know, foot in the door to a more aggressive war on journalism and press freedom? What are your thoughts?
Here's one thing that I want to point out. It was under the Obama administration that we had more leakers being prosecuted than any other administration.
That's
and that's not a political statement.
It's simple
that's
fact.
Simply math.
Yeah.
But what is concerning to me right now is, let's say that WikiLeaks is a publication, you know, it's being disseminated, it falls under the First Amendment. The concern is that the government now is taking a different tactic, you know, not going after the publication directly, you know, trying to shut it down directly, but trying to kind of make an end run around the First Amendment by saying, okay, Assange, you conspired to get this information. Now we have, I think, what might be a new ball game.
And what might
because
that...
Because this conspiring to get information, that's kind of a collateral attack, if you want.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's kind of a sideways move. If you're not going to try to shut down using, say, the Espionage Act. You're not trying to shut down a publication for publishing the classified information. Instead, you're trying a different tactic. You're going to say, you conspired with the leaker to get the information.
Now,
so that's...
Well, I was just going to ask, I mean, Obama did not have a great record on press freedom, as you mentioned, but his Justice Department ultimately decided it was too dangerous to prosecute WikiLeaks without putting news organizations such as The Times and The Guardian at risk. How qualitatively different is the Trump Justice Department on this, do you think, or is it not that qualitatively different?
I think it's a continuum. When you look at the people who were prosecuted under the Obama administration, people like Thomas Drake and Jeffrey Sterling, who were giving information to James Risen. When you look at John Kiriakou, I think it's interesting. Kiriakou, a CIA agent who broke the news of the waterboarding that we were doing.
Oh, right, right.
And who was the only person prosecuted for waterboarding? It was John Kiriakou who leaked the information. We had a Pulitzer Prize winning story on waterboarding and what we were doing. Again, transparency. Do we need to know what our government is doing? If it's embarrassing, then
yes.
it seems to me that there's a good chance of prosecution, going all the way back to the Pentagon Papers. And Ellsberg, of course, Ellsberg was brought up on charges of violating the Espionage Act of 1917. And what spared him way back then was that John Mitchell and his troops at the Justice Department were illegally gathering information from Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, illegal wiretapping, if you want. So because of government misconduct, the charges against Ellsberg were dropped. But here we had a situation with Chelsea Manning, sentenced to 35 years in prison for violating the Espionage Act. And, well, all this, anyway, serves some time, but President Obama did commute Chelsea Manning's sentence, didn't pardon Chelsea Manning, but commuted the sentence. So I guess that shows kind of the softer side of President Obama and his administration. If Assange were in prison, would Trump and his administration commute the sentence? I doubt it.
Yeah, if he makes it alive, quite frankly. And I can understand why he and, I mean, people have called Edward Snowden a coward for not facing justice. But there are people, I mean, I've talked to people who would say they would kill him, and they have legitimate reason to be frightened. And, Trump said he doesn't know anything about WikiLeaks. Now, of course, during his campaign in 2016, he said he loved WikiLeaks. And what?
Right.
What about
love is?
You mentioned the Espionage Act of 1917, and that was a terrible, in my opinion, assault on freedom of speech and the press back in 1917. Great harm was done against the right to dissent and publish freely. A lot of people were hurt. And it was really a clampdown on our traditional First Amendment rights. How does that come into play regarding the Assange case?
Okay, the 1917 Espionage Act is still in effect. It is the current law, if you want. It's been amended somewhat. But 1917, we get this Espionage Act that says, among other things, that you can't obstruct military recruitment. We have the first big First Amendment case in this country that happens in 1919. And what we have is this. We have socialists, leftists, socialists, and folks of communist persuasion who are very much opposed to our draft. They also think that capitalism, of course, is causing unspeakable misery to the working class. And, you know, we've had the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, all these kind of things going on. But we have Schenck as the first case, and he was saying that the draft was a violation of the 13th Amendment of the Constitution, which, of course, prohibits involuntary servitude. And I think that sounds like a pretty interesting argument. But, of course, he was arrested under the Espionage Act for obstructing military recruitment, and it was Oliver Wendell Holmes who wrote that first decision. And we get the famous line that, you know, you can't falsely shout fire in a theater. So when it comes to the First Amendment and the Espionage Act, Oliver Wendell Holmes comes up with the clear and present danger test. So you have to look at the context, you have to look at the words, and you have to decide if they create a clear and present danger. Well, the clear and present danger test was a clear and present danger to freedom of expression.
Yes, it was.
Because applying that in these Espionage Act cases only resulted in the escape from punishment for one group of people, and that was Jehovah's Witnesses during World War II, when they did not want to salute the flag, and of course they did. They were pacifist. Every other time that you had cases coming up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court using clear and present danger, the government won. It wasn't until 1969 that we got what I would call true freedom of political expression in this country. And it was a case of Brandenburg versus Ohio, and it will always gall me. Brandenburg was a Ku Klux Klan leader. And he was giving his speech about how we'd have to take revengeance, you know, for what was going on. Oh, my. And the Supreme Court then changed the law. Now you have to show that there is intent, there is imminence, and there's likelihood of incitement of some sort of violent illegal activity. But this clear and present danger test just spelled doom for freedom of expression for so many people.
Wow. And I wonder how that could come into play in this current Assange case. You know, is there a clear and present danger from what he and Manning showed, or is it more of a clear and present danger from a potential government crackdown? And having to show intent and eminence and likelihood, wow, that's a big hurdle for the government to overcome, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost impossible now to meet that standard. But it's so important, again, back to the purpose of the First Amendment, the Supreme Court saying it's the chief guarantee of that amendment to prohibit prior restraint. And if you have the kind of situation that we have going on now, I'm afraid, what we're going to end up with is a real chilling effect.
Right.
I think it's important for the people of this country to know what our government is up to. Collateral murder, the Afghani war logs, the Iraqi war logs, like the Pentagon Papers, revealed information that I think it's pretty clear the government would have preferred not be out there in the open. But back to Louis Brandeis and sunshine is the best disinfectant. If we know, for instance, that the government is illegally eavesdropping on our conversations, you know, somebody like Snowden blowing the whistle, then we ultimately did get some changes in the law. When it comes to the Vietnam War. You get this kind of information coming out, and you do get a turning of the tide of the public sentiment.
And that's what the government was afraid of, clearly.
Yes.
And, you know, you think about repressive governments like the old Soviet Union, like East Germany, North Korea, one imagines, there's no freedom of the press there. You have to believe what you are told. And I think, I'd like to think that that's one thing that really differentiates us as, you know, traditional, genuinely conservative Americans, conserving the Constitution and our values, from those other repressive nations. I wonder about national security, the term national security. The government used that, I think, in the Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers and stuff. And just using national security on one hand against the people's right to know on the other. And I'm certainly concerned about a government being empowered to become even more authoritarian and violating lots of people's freedom of speech. And I think that could have a lot to do with the Assange case. And, you know, he's seen as such a vile person by so many people, and there's not a lot of support for him. The news surrounding him is anything but clear. And Hillary Clinton, for example, said it's not about journalism, it's about assisting hacking into a military computer. I can't imagine that there's a clear line between what journalism is and hacking into a computer when it comes to, you know, an argument that the public has a right to know what's going on, like, for example, with the collateral murder.
Well, here's part of what the law says, and that's that if it is a valid criminal law, then there is no First Amendment defense to breaking it. So, if indeed you had a situation where a journalist was illegally intercepting or truly conspiring, then you could have this principle that, you know, it's a violation of a valid law. But if what we have is a clear case of leaking and we have journalists with clean hands, we go back to that other set of principles, which is that so long as the hands are clean, the journalist has one job only, and that's to decide if the information is of legitimate public concern. Bartnicki versus Vopper, Pearson versus Dodd. You know, we've got case law that backs that up.
Yes, there is a lot of precedent, and that's what we're trying to talk about here with regard to this Assange thing. I mean, it's whipped up pretty strong, and, you know, a lot of people, the spin has been put out that Assange was not a journalist. He was helping Russia mess with our election and attack the Hillary Clinton campaign with the data breaches. Is there any evidence of that, do you think?
Well, the Assange problem right now is the 2010 leak.
Right. That's way before.
That's the subject matter now. And then we get into the Russian situation and all that. But that's after the fact. You know, the 2010 data breaches, that's the issue at hand right now for Assange. And you know, what you were saying, I think is so important about what separates a democratic society from an autocratic society. You know, this notion of secrecy. And back to what Daniel Ellsberg said when he heard about what was happening with Assange early on. Secrecy is essential to empire. Ah. I just think that's a wonderful quote.
And I'm not sure you can have empire and a republic at the same time. There's a great quote from Jimmy Carter, whom I've come to respect quite a bit. He said, I did not deplore the WikiLeaks revelations. They just made public what was actually the truth. Most often, the revelation of the truth, even if unpleasant, is beneficial. What can people do from here, do you think? If people, I mean, it's very confusing. There's a lot of spin. You know, they're painting Assange as this just terrible person here. I guess he'll probably be extradited to the United States and the charge will be relative to the 2010 situation. Any recommendations for, you know, if somebody cares about the First Amendment, as do I, as do you, is there any suggestions you may have? Any, well, of course, the ACLU is always there fighting for this, and they've had some great comments, and they're, you know, defending freedom of the press on this. Your suggestions, Professor Davidson?
I think that people should stand up for the principle that publication of truthful information, no matter how embarrassing, should be something that we support. Publication of truthful information. We find out what is going on with the wars. We find out information such as, were there weapons of mass destruction?
You're right.
We know that there have been mistakes, and there's a difference between mistakes and lies, but we have to be vigilant. We have to be on guard. We can, of course, voice our opinions in the voting booth, but in these days of the internet, in these days of Twitter and all, if we support the First Amendment, if we support the right to receive truthful information, we can certainly make our opinions known. Again, the First Amendment does not define who is a journalist. We can write letters to the editor. We can Twitter. We can do whatever. We can voice our support for getting information. We can voice our support to our people in Congress.
Yes, we can, and they do
care
about
that. To our state legislators as well. You know, if you want information, I think it's important to be vocal about the fact. If silent, and if we just let what's going to happen unfold without any form of protest, that is concerning. And I will be honest, I do believe in the right of protest. And we have had some really interesting protests. People getting out, you know, in numbers. I think that can really impress upon the government. If you are out there protesting in numbers for a right that you think is essential, you have to hope that at least some of the folks in our government will listen.
Yeah, it's worked before. And as someone said, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. We have to be vigilant. We do. Thank you so much for shedding light into the legal context of and precedent for what's going on with the Assange case right now. Sandra Davidson, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you so much for this invitation.
Thank you. It's about freedom.